ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
महाविष्णुपदाय कृष्णप्रस्थाय गुरुदेव श्रीमद्भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामिनेति नाम्ने नमस्ते सरस्वत देवी गौरवाणी प्रचारणे नर विशेष शनिवारी पाश्चात्यलेश चरणे श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव श्री गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्णा कृष्ण कृष्ण हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 84, verse 14. Sri Suka Uvasa, Isamyetam, Bhagavata, Krishnasya, Akunta, Medasa, Vacho, Duranvayam, Vipras, Tushni, Asan, Brahmad. Shri Suka Uvacha Samyetam Bhagavata Krishna Syakunta Medasa Vacha Duran Vayam Vipras Tushnim Asan Brahmadhyaya
Tushnim Asan Brahmadhyaya
Nishamyetam Bhagavata
Nishamyetam Bhagavata
Krishnasyakuntamedasa
Krishnasyakuntamedasa
Vachaduranvayam Vipras
Vachaduranvayam Vipras
Tushnim Asan Brahmadhyaya
Tushnim Asan Brahmadhyaya
Sri Suka Uvacha Sukadeva Goswami said Nishamya Hearing Yetam
Such
Bhagavata
of
the Supreme Lord
Krishnasya
Krishna Akunta
Unrestricted
Medasa
Medasa
Wisdom.
Wisdom.
Vacha.
Vacha.
Words.
Words.
Duranvayam.
Duranvayam.
Difficult to comprehend.
Vipras. Vipras.
Learned Brahmanas.
Learned Brahmanas.
Tushnim.
Tushnim.
Silent.
Silent.
Asan.
Asan.
Word.
Word.
Brahmat.
Brahmat.
Unsteady.
Unsteady.
Diya.
Yeah.
Their minds.
Yeah.
Translation. Sukadeva Goswami said, hearing such unfathomable words from the unlimitedly wise, Lord Krishna, the learned Brahmanas, remained silent, their minds bewildered. For some time, the sages pondered the Lord's behavior, which resembled that of a subordinate living being. They concluded that he was acting this way to instruct the people in general. Thus they smiled and spoke to him, the spiritual master of the universe. Sridhar Swami explains the word ishitavyata as referring to one's not being a controller, in other words, to being under the law of karma, obliged to work and experience the results of one's work. While addressing the sages, Lord Krishna accepted the role of subordinate living being to emphasize the importance of hearing and serving saintly Vaishnavas. The personality of God is also the supreme teacher of spiritual surrender. Sukadeva Goswami said, hearing such unfathomable words from the unlimitedly wise Lord Krishna, the learned Brahmanas remained silent, their minds bewildered. For some time the sages pondered the Lord's behavior, which resembled that of a subordinate living being. They concluded he was acting this way to instruct the people in general. Thus they smiled and spoke to him, the spiritual master of the universe. When Krishna speaks, often he speaks very gravely and very deeply.
One of the characteristics of Krishna is Gambhira, which means very deep. And one could translate that as meaning very unfathomable or inscrutable. So we get puzzled by the Supreme Lord in His actions and His words. Of course, we also understand that the Lord likes to deliver the living entities and teach them very nicely. Therefore, the word should be very clear. So, for instance, when Krishna speaks Bhagavad Gita, he is clarifying the Vedic literatures and he very simply explains things. However, the Lord does not always explain things simply. Sometimes he hides the meaning. So we cannot always expect Lord Krishna to speak everything very directly. And therefore we'll have some controversies about what Lord Krishna says and what he teaches. Or not only Krishna, other sages and the Vedas themselves. And as we see, there is controversy about the Vedas, particularly the Upanishads. So we have Shankaracharya having one meaning, and then we have Vaishnavacharyas with a completely different meaning for the same text. And even if we take Srimad Bhagavatam, in many cases there will be one meaning, and some people will take that meaning, and the Vaishnavacharyas will take an opposite meaning. So the nature of language, and particularly Sanskrit language, is such that sometimes you can have several meanings in the same statement. And we'll see sometimes, for instance, the demons will speak and they'll describe the Supreme Lord as a rascal and a cheater and whatever. And at the same time, those same words are interpreted by the Acharya to mean the opposite. So the demon is actually praising the Supreme Lord, even though his intention is to criticize the Lord. When the Acharya takes the same sentence and statement, then he'll have a meaning which is the opposite, not intended by the demon, but nevertheless probably intended by Sukadeva Goswami and Vasudeva when they composed the text. So there'll be two meanings to it. In other words, the devotees don't like to hear criticism of the Lord, so when they're describing the demons speak, they also have another meaning for the devotees. So in this way, there's no offense to the Lord on the part of the devotee speaking. The Bhagavatam is like that, and Krishna is like that. Also, the Supreme Lord is like that, and the other Vedic literatures are also like that. They're not always direct, and therefore there is controversy. Now we can always ask the question, well, why would the Lord like controversy? The Vedas are non-different from the Supreme Lord, and he should state the truth clearly so that the jivas don't get confused. But we have to understand the real world, and the scriptures also preach in terms of people of different qualifications. So some people are qualified for karma, some for jnana, some for yoga, and some for bhakti. And therefore the Lord will give different teachings for different people. And this way He accommodates everybody and is merciful to everyone. So those who are stuck with karma yoga and jnana yoga are not qualified for bhakti yoga. And therefore, the Lord hides the truth from these persons. Sometimes if the jnani or the karmi will read everything, he'll become confused if Krishna simply says, actually karma yoga is worthless and jnana yoga is worthless and sangha yoga is worthless, just do bhakti. So then the person will lose his faith in karma yoga and he will not be qualified for bhakti yoga, therefore he'll do nothing. So the Lord also encourages people in the different modes, and therefore we do have, for instance, the Puranas written by Veda Vyas. We have Tamasic Puranas, Rajasic Puranas, and Sattvic Puranas, meant for people of different qualification. Those who are qualified for Tamagun should follow the Tamagun Puranas, and those in Rajagun follow the Rajagun Puranas, those in Sattvagun follow the Sattvagun Puranas. So that is, and then we have Karma Kanda in the Vedas, and we have Gyan Kanda, and then we have Bhakti as well. So we have the Vedas also explaining to different people. So we have to accept that as there, and at the same time the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, I give people the faith by which they can follow these different processes, by which they can worship devatas, etc. So if we look at the Rajasic or the Tamasic Puranas, then there'll be praise of Lord Shiva, or praise of Lord Brahma, and different devatas. And they'll say they are the absolute truth, they are the final truth is the highest, they are the cause of all causes, etc. And then if we look in the Bhagavatam, we'll say Krishna is the cause of all causes. So how can everybody be the cause of all causes? And then one becomes confused. So the idea is we have to accept some texts as relative to certain people and other texts as absolute. So this becomes a little confusing for people, because they may just take one text and, you know, concentrate on that and get some conclusion, and then we come along with another text and say, well, this one negates that one, so I reject this. So very confusing. Just to solve the confusion, therefore, we do have texts like Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, which clarify the issue. If you want to go through very intelligently, then you can come to the conclusion nicely, and there's no discrepancy there. And everything makes sense, and we'll understand what is the highest truth. So there are texts which clarify the truth. But as I said, because the Supreme Lord is catering to everybody, therefore sometimes he will hide the truth about bhakti. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna will hide bhakti sometimes, even though it is supposed to be, you know, rejecting all the dharmas, all cheating dharmas, and only presenting bhakti. We will find karma yoga here, we'll find jnana yoga, we'll stop finding astanga yoga. Very systematically explained in the Bhagavatam. And if you go to the 11th canto of Bhagavatam and you read that, sometimes you may even doubt what the conclusion is, because it talks about jnana and merging in Brahman, etc. as if it's the highest truth. So we have to be, the devotee of course understands the conclusion, and therefore we take these things in a secondary way. But for the jnani, he will be very happy when he reads Bhagavatam, because finally he'll say, oh, see, now we know that Brahman is supreme, because after all Krishna's pastimes in the 10th canto, we get a glorification of jnana in the 11th canto. So jnana is the final, you know, truth. And so the jnani will be very happy with this conclusion. But of course, if we look further, we look in the 12th canto at the very end, then we'll see again, it comes back to Krishna again and bhakti yoga. So Krishna does disguise things sometimes from different people, and in fact hides things intentionally because people are not qualified for some things. So that is what it means when we say Krishna speaks in a puzzling manner sometimes, or he speaks with unfathomable words. For instance, even when the Kumaras went up to Vaikuntha, and then they wanted to see the Lord, and giant Vija, the gatekeepers, became very angry at them, and they showed their red eyes, and they began speaking harshly to the Kumaras, and they said, oh, you cannot go in here, you're not qualified, you're just little children. And then the Kumaras got angry, and then they cursed them and said, you are puffed up gatekeepers, you're not qualified to be in Vaikuntha, we curse you to go into the material world. So it was a big argument. And then Vishnu suddenly appeared and everybody stopped arguing. And then Vishnu spoke. And then after he spoke, the Kumaras, who are jnanis and very intelligent, they looked at each other and they said, what does it mean? We can't understand what the Lord said. What is actually trying to say? Is he praising us? Because the Lord was praising the Brahmanas and saying, please forgive my servants, you know, because they don't know anything. And he was praising the Brahmins, and so he was praising the Kumaras, but then they understood, maybe he's not praising us after all. So they were very doubtful about really the intention of the Lord. The words say one thing, maybe the Lord's intention is something else. Therefore, the Lord's words are like that. And then, of course, later on, the Lord explained everything very nicely, and it was very clear that actually he was attached to the gatekeepers, and he did not want to separate them. And he took them as his own persons. But at the same time, all of his words could be interpreted in two ways also. So one can pick one meaning or a different meaning also. So the Lord is like this. Another quality of the Lord, he's very clever. So therefore, his words can mean many things for many different people according to their inclination or their qualification. So, of course, in this way, the Lord never speaks the untruth. He's always very truthful. At the same time, he likes to satisfy everybody. So that's why he will speak like this in many cases. Another example is when Krishna speaks to the gopis here in the Bhagavatam when he meets the gopis in Kurukshetra. Also when he sends his letter with Uddhava to Vrindavan. Ultimately what he says is, you should actually understand that I'm the Paramatma situated everywhere. And then you should understand this and become yogis. And this way you'll be very satisfied, even if I don't come back. So this, of course, is contrary. Ultimately, if we examine Kalsi, this is very strange, because how can Krishna glorify yoga process when he's already glorified the inhabitants of Vrindavan as being higher than the Gyanis and the Karmis and the Yogis, higher than the people of Mathura? He said that actually they're higher than everybody else. And at the same time, he's telling them, oh, I want you just to become yogis and meditate on me. So we do see, if we're intelligent, we see this contradiction here. But on the surface, it looks as if Krishna is recommending yoga. So this will satisfy the yogis. They'll say, look, yoga is superior to bhakti, because now Krishna is telling the gopis to become satisfied with doing Ashtanga yoga. But of course, we know that's contrary. So if you take the same text, the same letter, and you examine it very closely, then you can get another meaning out of it. And Krishna's not saying this at all. So this is how Krishna speaks sometimes. He'll give different meanings. So in this way we'll find the words of Krishna are not always, we cannot always take their surface meaning. In this particular case, Krishna is also speaking like an ordinary person and saying that I also have to get the instructions, of the mercy of devotees, and I'm under the law of karma, etc. And so the Lord will put himself in the position of a human being. Now this is particularly true of Krishna. Of course, Vishnu also does that when he spoke to the Kumaras. But Krishna is more likely to do this and act like a human being, saying, well, I'm under the laws of karma, I'm just an ordinary person, I'm just an ordinary cowherd boy or whatever. I am controlled by my family members or whatever. Because Krishna's role as Krishna is to he is Manusha Rupa. He has a human form, and therefore he acts very much like a human being, and therefore it's very difficult to detect if he is God or not. So some people will say, see, Krishna's saying here I'm under the law of karma. See, he's actually material, he's got a material body. This is part of Krishna's Leela. As a cowherd boy or as the king of Dwarka, he's acting like a human being in his pastimes. And it may be very difficult for some people to detect that he's not, because of the statements he makes and the way he acts. He acts just like a normal human being. We also see, for instance, when he was fighting with a demon, then the demon had a big illusion there and he cut off his father's head. And then Krishna begins to lament. Like a normal person, and cry and everything. Oh, my father, he's dead. So then one will say, see, Krishna is also under the control of the modes of nature. Just like he's criticizing Arjuna. When Arjuna is lamenting for his, I'll have to kill my relatives. So then Krishna is acting in the same way. So in this way, people who are atheists or whatever, they'll criticize Krishna. And this way, Krishna hides. He hides himself from the materialists and demons. So in a sense, the whole of Krishna's pastimes are like that. One can take him as a normal human being. And for instance, also when he left Mathura, he kind of ran away. And he ran away from Jarasandha, etc. He ran away from Kaliyavana. He fled from him. So then people were like, well, how can the Supreme Lord run away and be defeated by anybody? So the Lord acts, when he's Krishna, he acts in a very different way from the other appearances. So this will help to cover up Krishna and make people assume that he is a regular human being. But Krishna has a purpose behind all of this when he does this. So the Lord is, we cannot understand his acts, we cannot understand his words all the time. There is many layers of meaning there. The ultimate meaning of is, and the purpose of everything is, to satisfy his devotees. That's the ultimate purpose. And to give pleasure to his devotees, to satisfy his devotees in all ways. And to do that, then often these indirect routes are taken where Krishna appears like he's material or whatever, and he's doing acts like a materialist. Therefore we have to very carefully understand Krishna's words and his pastimes so that we don't become bewildered. Krishna Chakravarti says that the whole of the Bhagavatam is like Mohini. And Mohini, of course, means one who bewilders. And what did Mohini Avatar do? The Supreme Lord became a woman, a very beautiful woman, and then she bewildered the demons. And the demons were so bewildered that they gave the nectar to her when she asked for the nectar, in spite of the fact that that was the whole goal, to get the nectar so they could, become immortal. And they churned the milky ocean, they grabbed it. And then when Mohini asked for the nectar, then they gave it to her without even protesting. So the power of illusion was so great that then they thought that she's so beautiful and she likes us so much that we'll do anything for her and she'll do anything for us. So when she asked for the nectar, they gave it to her and said, they thought, oh, she'll give it back to us because she's so nice and she likes us. And immediately she took the nectar and gave it to the devatas. So in this way there was great bewilderment on the part of the demons. So the Bhagavatam is like that. It will bewilder the materialists and the demons and the impersonalists, etc. And they will get a completely different meaning from it. And Krishna provides the means for them to do that. Krishna's acts and Krishna's words and Krishna's letters and stuff. And then they will think, yes, Krishna is actually not God. He's material, under the control of karma. So, because they're unqualified, therefore the Lord likes to hide. So the Bhagavatam is like Mohini for the demons. But for the devotees, it's different. Just as Mohini gave the nectar to the devatas. So in the same way, Bhagavatam gives nectar to the devotees. And they understand that Krishna is only deluding the demons by certain statements in certain sections of the Bhagavatam. But actually, the devotees appreciate the Lord for what he's doing. So that's how we have to understand the whole of the Bhagavatam. There is many instances of bewilderment. Even the passing away of Krishna, how he disappears, very bewildering, even for devotees. How can the Lord disappear like that and get shot in the foot by an arrow and then leave a material body and the body gets burned and whatever? How can the Yadavas fight with each other when they're pure devotees and then they have a quarrel and they get drunk? They start drinking liquor and they get drunk and then they kill each other. How is it possible? And yet it's described directly like that in the Bhagavad, this huge battle, and they're fighting with the weapons, and they pick up the reeds and they fight with that, and there's a curse there, and Krishna gets cursed and he dies from the lump of one of the children's, they disguise themselves as a pregnant woman, and the sages curse them, and because of this curse, therefore that little piece of metal pierced Krishna's foot, and then he died. So it looks like Krishna's affected by a curse there, and he leaves the material body and everything. So that is an appearance that Krishna can have, and is therefore bewildering the demons and the materialists. And that way they'll think, yes, Krishna is a material person, let's go on with karma or whatever we're doing. and the devotees, on the other hand, will understand that this is only an appearance that the Lord does. They will understand the Lord acts in strange ways sometimes. And that is exactly what the Brahmins here understand. Yeah, the Lord is speaking like this in a rather mysterious way. We cannot take the superficial meaning of what he says, and we have to take deeper meaning. So the devotees have to do that when they read Srimad Bhagavatam. They have to understand there are some places where it looks contrary to the Lord. Therefore, there must be another meaning there. And because we are not so intelligent, therefore, the acharyas will give us the other meaning. They'll help us and give us the other meaning so that we can make sense of everything. And in that way, there is no contradiction to the Lord and his activities. Everything is harmonious, ultimately. So that appearance is sometimes there. So we should not be disturbed by that. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, Krishna is glorifying karma yoga in chapter 3, for instance. And then someone has written the whole Bhagavad Gita commentary based on the glorification of karma yoga. And they take the whole Bhagavad Gita as the glorification of karma yoga. That karma yoga is what we should do. And so this is the extent that Krishna can bewilder people in the material world. But when we read it, we obviously see that karma yoga is secondary, because Krishna rejects that in chapter 9. He says, worship of devatas is useless, it's bad, it's not the right process, etc. But some people get bewildered by this. When Krishna says, you know, do karma yoga, you're not qualified for jnana, whatever, just do karma yoga, it is the best process. So they'll take those statements and they'll interpret the whole Bhagavad Gita in terms of those statements. So that is how Krishna acts sometimes. So we have to therefore read the scriptures carefully, and we have to consider the commentaries of the acharyas, and then we'll get the actual truth about what is presented in the scriptures. Otherwise we can get bewildered. Okay, any questions?
The Skanda Purana has 81,000 verses, mainly glorifying Lord Shiva, in comparison to the Bhagavatam, which has 18,000 verses, which is Lord Vishnu. So people can get bewildered by this sort of thing.
Yeah. See, this one's a bigger one, therefore it's better. Therefore Shiva is the best.
So if people have got this sort of muddled understanding, especially Indian people, when they have a muddled understanding, they've heard different things from different sources. How can we bring them, what's the best way to bring them to clarity, like the Vaishnava clarity on the whole thing?
Well, one, of course, we do have to listen to authorities, and parampara, we cannot, you know, interpret on our own, that's one thing. So we should take the authorities. Second, of course, we should understand the priority of the gunas. And we have tamagun, rajagun, and sattva-gun. They're all gunas, actually, but sattva is preferable to rajas and tamas. And I think everyone in India will have to accept that. And Shiva's in charge of tamagun, and Brahma's in charge of rajagun, and Vishnu's in charge of sattva-gun. So automatically there's some sort of hierarchy there also. But though Krishna's in charge of sattva-gun, he is not sattvic, and he's not in any way dealing with it, actually. He's above it. He's completely untouched by it, completely. And though he preaches sattva-gun over the other gunas, actually, ultimately, he preaches bhakti. Whereas Shiva, of course, he is also Supreme Lord, so he's not really touched by the gunas, but he is in very close contact with them, and he's catering to the people in tamagun. So he gives advice to people in tamagun. But as we say, tamagun is an inferior mode, so it's not absolute, therefore, and we have to go up to sattva and then go beyond sattva to get the absolute truth. So if we want the highest truth, therefore, we cannot bog ourselves down in the tama and rajagun, even sattva-gun. We have to go beyond that. But people have to have intelligence to really understand this. You know, they have to understand the gunas, and they have to understand the different types of worship and the results and what they give. And then if they have that intelligence, then they can see that ultimately we have to worship some entity who's beyond the gunas completely and does not give you results which are in the gunas.
In the same way, what Yogi Shastra is asking, we can also read that in the Brahma Samhita and other Shastras.
Yeah, of course, they'll say, what is the Brahma Samhita? It's not the Vedas, it's not the Puranas. So there is a difficulty there. So we accept Sampradaya, fine, because we accept Lord Chaitanya, and Lord Chaitanya takes this as authority, fine, but others may not. But even if they accept Bhagavatam, same as in Bhagavatam, we don't find elaborate glorification of the devatas and everything, and at most they're considered persons who are empowered by the Lord. That's the extent the devatas have in their existence. You know?
How do we present the Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita as being higher than the other Puranas? For example, I doubt that the Tamagun Puranas would say this Purana is in Tamagun and therefore others are higher. So a person who reads the Tamagun, you know, the ones in Tamagun, would reasonably think that it's higher, you know, just as valid as
other. Yeah. Well, one will have to understand, of course, that these are presented according to qualification. The other is, of course, the standard. They just standardize which Puranas are what, you know. By even scholars will accept that, you know, these ones are the Tamagun ones, these are the Rajasic ones, these are the Sattvic ones, and you know. So in general, people will accept that. They're not going to challenge that. And we also know that obviously Satvaguna is superior to Rajan Tamaguna, so if there's a contradiction, we should take the conclusion of the Sattvic Puranas over the Tamasic or Rajagun Puranas. That's also, you know, logical thing. If we find a statement like that, then we should take that. That's the argument of Jiva Goswami, says we should, you know, do that. And then the Bhagavatam, of course, is beyond the gunas. It is Amala Purana. It is Nirguna. It is about bhakti and the Supreme Lord is beyond the gunas. So, therefore, if the Bhagavatam says something, that statement should stand against any other statement, and if it's a contradiction, we should take the Bhagavatam as the final authority. Not only the Puranas, then if you look at the Upanishads, we'll find similar. They will reject all this worship of devatas and whatever as karma, and karma will be considered inferior. So it's not that the Bhagavatam is isolated. Huh? It is actually the conclusion of the Brahma Sutras, and the Brahma Sutras are the conclusion of the Upanishads, and the Upanishads are the conclusion of the Vedas. So, no, they're all related to each other, and they don't have differing conclusions. But because it's all spread out, therefore it'll be a little difficult for the normal person to gather all that together and come to the right conclusion. So that's why we do have to accept the opinion of the Acharyas. And then they'll point it out, and then based on that, then you can go back and look at the, you know, Upanishads and what they say. And the Vedanta Sutra, you can look at that and what it says. But if we're all on our own, it's very difficult to figure out. Yeah, Sutra Sattva means beyond the gunas, near guna, beyond the gunas. Yeah. Yeah, that is Sura Sattva. The Sattva that's in the material world is not pure. And when we talk about Sattva Gun and the Brahmanas and people who are in Sattva Gun and things which are in Sattva Gun, they are prominently Sattvic, but not completely Sattva. There's always a mixture there. So one who's a Brahman in Sattva Gun will sometimes show Rajas or Tamas. He cannot be perfect. It's only a prominence of gunas that by which we classify things in the material world.
You mentioned that Krishna hides bhakti in the Bhagavatam, different ways.
What's that? Hides. Yeah.
And is that to encourage the Kalyani so that they can read the Bhagavatam more?
Well, that's one reason is that when Sukadeva was present and explained to Parikshit, there were all these sages there. There was yogis and gyanis and bhaktas and so many different types of people there. So therefore, to please those particular persons, and also because they weren't qualified, therefore he'll speak on jnana and talk about merging in Brahman, etc. It's very prominent in the 11th canto. Therefore, the commentary in the 11th canto is also very prominent because Jiva Goswami and Vishwanatha are explaining, actually, this is like this, but we should not take this as absolute, you know. And of course, the other thing is that Krishna likes to hide in the sense that bhakti is confidential. Rajaguhyam. It is the king of secrets. It's the king of knowledge, but it's the king of secrets. So it is a little bit secret. And the Lord doesn't like to give it to everyone. And we find one of the qualities of bhakti, the fourth quality, or second, the third quality maybe. It's sudurlabha. Bhakti is rarely attained. Why? Because Krishna doesn't like to give it to everybody. Only those who are qualified, he'll give himself and he'll give bhakti. So, therefore, in that sense, it's a little rare. And of course, Bhagavatam directly says that in the 8th canto, it says, and also 11th canto, I think it is, that this is paroksha. The sages prefer paroksha, and I also prefer paroksha. That means hidden meaning or indirect statements. I'm just literal and clear. Indirectly, he'll speak sometimes. In that way, it's confidential. And in the same way, we can see even why is the Bhagavad Gita, you know, we have Karma Yoga and the first six chapters, Bhakti Yoga and the second six chapters, and Jnana and the last six chapters. So then the question would be, well, if bhakti is the conclusion, why don't we go karma yoga, jnana yoga, then bhakti yoga? We put bhakti at the end. Then it would be quite clear that Krishna's concluding with six chapters on bhakti yoga. And then, and what if he's closing the jnana and everything, then the jnanis are going to say, well, see, jnana is the final conclusion after all this bhakti. So then, why does Krishna do it like that? So the answer is, again, it's confidential. Krishna hides it. And Vishwan Chakravarti, he compares the Bhagavad Gita to a jewel box, you know, where you have a box, you know, and you put your precious jewel in it. So the first six chapters are like the box, and the last six chapters are like the lid, and the middle six chapters are bhakti, or the jewel in the middle. And they're covered up. The box is there to protect them, and you don't really see it from the outside, but you open it up and you see, you get the jewel. So that way bhakti is in the middle, it's a little bit hidden because it is confidential.
Maharaj,
what is the Mohini analogy for? That's Krishna Chakravarti. He states that in the first verse, the end of the first verse commentary he has, it states that the Bhagavatam is Mohini. And then several places in the Bhagavatam he'll say that also. The Lord likes to disguise things sometimes and not let the jnanis and others taste the nectar because they're not qualified for it and they'll become offenders.
Look, when the jiva by nature is a bhakta,
mm-hmm.
So when we say somebody's not qualified for bhakti, the actual...
Well, we say everyone's Nitya Krishna Das. Yeah. But we see in the material world, some people are demons, and they go down, and the Lord says they go down and sink down and down and down, you know, into lower species of life until they become plants or whatever. It's almost as if they're eternally condemned. Yes. So then, how are they Krishna's servants? So that's everybody's Krishna's servants in one sense because they're all following. They're naturally subordinate to Krishna. That's one thing. The jiva is by nature a subordinate entity. And the second, of course, is because the law of karma is acting on their behalf and the Lord wants to deliver everybody, but the jiva by his free will has to act also. So the law of karma is there, and when they're ready to act nicely, then they rise up again and they can actually get out of the material world and you know, go to the spiritual world. So in that sense, Krishna is acting for their benefit, ultimately. So in that sense, we can say they're servants of Krishna also, though indirectly in the material world, because we're trying to be independent. Though we can say that the bhakti is there, at the same time we also say the guru and Krishna plant the seed of bhakti. So if it's already there, why do we need a seed at all? So in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya says it's a seed, and by the mercy of guru and Krishna we get the seed of bhakti, and that's how it begins. And also in the Bhagavatam we'll find that it is not automatic that everybody becomes a devotee after so many billions of births. If bhakti was natural, and everybody then naturally, everyone would gravitate towards bhakti eventually after so many lives of Brahma in the material world, they'd all elevate gradually up and end up in the spiritual world. But it's not like that. They'd wander around in the material world. And it's only by the grace of devotees and the mercy of Krishna that suddenly they get bhakti and they're able to, practice bhakti. So it is by the mercy of devotees in the material world that the jiva gets bhakti, and then he's saved from the material world, not otherwise. So though we may say that bhakti there somewhere doesn't really activate at all, it's only when we get the mercy of devotees and suddenly we get this bhakti love of beach, and then it grows.
So why someone is ineligible when you get the mercy of the devotees?
So when they're ready, if they're not, they don't have any faith, they don't have the bhakti lata bij, then they can do karma or jnana or yoga. And if they get the mercy of devotees, then they get faith, then they can give up all these things and just practice bhakti. So when we're talking about those qualified for jnana and yoga, karma means they never got any mercy of devotees in billions of lifetimes, it looks like. If they had, then that would have developed into faith, and then they would practice bhakti, and they would give up these other things. But if they're so attached to these things, that means they didn't get any mercy in past lifetimes, and therefore that seed didn't even if the mercy was given, it didn't become a seed that sprouted because of their offenses or whatever.
It's like their consciousness is locked at a certain
speaks on that feet, and I can't recall what it says, but something about is it sukriti
It's called agata sukriti. That sukriti is not punya. It's not by being sattvagun or doing charity works that then suddenly bhakti develops. Agata sukriti is acts of bhakti that happen to you without your doing it. In other words, somebody else is merciful to you, engages you in devotional service without your knowing about it. Because if you knew about it, you probably wouldn't do it. Because you don't have any faith. So accidental mercy of devotees, like getting prasadam or seeing the deity pass in the ratyatra, or hearing the holy name, someone chanting when you're walking down the street, or seeing a picture of the deity somewhere, of Krishna or Vishnu or any avatar, you suddenly see it and then you forget about it, that lifetime. Doing some service for the devotee when you don't know he's a devotee, like that. Or doing some service for the Lord when you don't think it's that. Or even fasting on Ekadasi when you don't know it's Ekadasi. Even that's Nigata Sukriti. So these are different things which gradually affect the Atma. The Atma gets affected a little bit by each of these unconscious things. And when the Atma builds up gradually, life after life, that's the Agata Sukriti, unconscious devotional acts. And at a certain point it becomes strong enough that that tendency will become conscious, and then you'll seek out, what is this devotional service? I'm a little interested in this. Or who is Krishna? Or who is God? And then we get curious about this, and we begin to ask around and try to seek. That's where faith comes. We have a natural tendency to believe in God. So that's the result of the agata sukriti over many births. When we get that faith, then we get devotee association, and then we start the devotional process.
So gradually do we become less and less acquainted with the fact we get
it? Yeah.
We're mentioning the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and that's the purpose of sacrifice in all that's different varieties is to give people an opportunity to gradually become
Yeah.
According to their faith, they might be attracted to those different types of sacrifice.
Yeah.
So that's
the gradual process. First you do karma yoga, and you go work your way up through the gunas, and then finally become a brahmana, and then you're sattvagun. And then sattvagun, the quality of sattvagun is knowledge and sukha. And that sukha means you're satisfied not with, sense enjoyment. You're satisfied with controlling your senses and actually getting some satisfaction within, in other words, atma. And the knowledge means that you can understand the difference between body and soul. So when you get the sattva, then you're qualified for jnana. And then you investigate and learn Vedanta and all this, and you say, I'm not the body, I'm the soul. And then if you go a little further, then you can do yoga. And then finally, if you get mercy of devotees after that, then you can do bhakti. So that's like the gradual process. The other process is just do bhakti whenever you get the mercy, and then give up the other processes completely.
That's why it says in the early time that anybody who chants the name is considered to have performed all of the
Not necessarily they have done them, because that means there's some sort of qualification for doing bhakti, but actually these are not qualifications for bhakti. You can do that for billions of lifetimes and still not get mercy of devotees and develop. So bhakti is independent of that, but whatever you accomplish by those processes is also accomplished by bhakti when you get bhakti. So whatever, when you do bhakti, then whatever you're supposed to achieve by karma in terms of going to Svarga Loka, you can get that by bhakti also. For instance, Dhruva got Dhruva Loka as a result of the Lord's mercy. Or if you want liberation, automatically through the process of bhakti, you go through liberation, you become free from the material world. But you get more than that, so even in bhava stage, it's all tucha. moksha is like, we don't want moksha, it's still insignificant because they've gone beyond that already in bhava by experiencing the Lord. So whatever you get in jnana is already accomplished by bhakti, whatever you get in karma is accomplished by bhakti, whatever you get in yoga in terms of siddhis, you can also get by bhakti. But the devotee doesn't want any of those things ultimately. So all he wants is service to the Lord. But everything is achieved by the devotee, so he's surpassed everything actually by simply following the process of bhakti. And that also means that he, by practicing bhakti, just chanting the name once, the chandala chants the name once of the Lord, and then he is qualified to do the savana or the sacrifice. That means that his karmas are destroyed when he starts doing bhakti. As Ajamil's karmas were also destroyed when he named his son Narayana, even that was Namabas, and he just accidentally named his son Narayana, then all his karmas got destroyed by that. And so the power of bhakti is so great that, and then we can say you're liberated at that stage.
But, some people take bhakti, but some people don't, when they're given an opportunity.
Yeah.
So there must be a qualification.
That's because they have faith. If they have faith, then they will accept. If they don't have faith, then they won't accept. But if they're not offensive, then that contact with bhakti will be an agata sukriti, and it will help them in the future. And if they're demons, then they will commit more aparadhas, and that will be worse for them.
And where's the material energy will sort them out?
Yeah, that's the only way they can. That's a long, long process.
But what determines the devotee doing it and not doing it?
Well, as I said, generally, agata sukriti is the process. Or, if there's very powerful mercy of a devotee, even if they're demonic, then they could actually transform immediately, as the case of Lord Chaitanya and Jagai Madai, Nityananda.
Or
Magari the Hunter, yeah. Then there's extreme change suddenly, then that's, of course, Kripa Siddhi. But the normal process for the jiva is to go gradually through agata sukriti, and then we develop a little faith. And then, when we contact devotion, we're ready to accept it.
And that ultimately comes as a result of the mercy of the devotees.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah. And the mercy of devotees, actually, where's the mercy coming from? Actually, it's Krishna Shakti, the sending of the devotee. So actually, it's coming from the spiritual world and coming into the jiva and then developing. You know? So it's not in the gunas at all. Whereas jnana is in the gunas and karma is in the gunas. But bhakti is beyond the gunas.
Is it fair to say that the Srimad Bhagavatam is not in the Purana and not in the Gunas because of
Tika? Oh, yeah. It's Amala. It's beyond the Gunas.
Yeah.
It's near Guna Purana. Transcendental.
So, the responsibility of the developing, like you mentioned in your discourse today, that we have Gandhi and coming over, etc. Should we have an element of graciousness when we're preaching and hold a certain responsibility? Do we open up bhakti to? Can we do something with great harm?
Well, we have the ninth aparadhana to the holy name. Don't preach to the faithless persons. So what do we do to those persons? How do we preach to them? Engage them in the Gyana Sukriti. Give them prasadam or something like that, or be very friendly with them and let them become attracted gradually somehow or other. And
so should we give them the graciousness to practice their qualification as well?
We could do that, but then ultimately our plan there is not that that's the best thing for them. We try to bring them over gradually by association. Otherwise, if we just turn them off and insult them, then nothing will happen to them. And then they give up a rods, and then they don't end up with anything.